Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. If you make home movies, that's sort of a family history, but it's not really the kind of family history that we're talking about today. We're talking about something a little more intricate, a little more sophisticated, and a little more grounded in historical procedures. Dr. Lauren McWaters is a professor of history at MTSU, and in the fall of this year, 2008, he is offering students the opportunity to make their own history documentary film for his History 3020 class, Topics in American History, Genealogy and Documentary Film, Doing Your Own Family History in Film. And the students have the option, since MTSU Centennial is coming up in 2011, of doing something about the history of this institution, if they so desire. The class will meet on Thursdays from 2:40 to 5:40, and it is already filled up. But it could be a really fascinating experience, and Dr. McWaters is here to talk with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This isn't the first time you've taught this class. When and how did the idea first occur to you?
Yeah, it will actually be the first time I've taught the class as a family history or genealogy class, because previously I've been working with graduate students. This is an undergraduate class. Mm-hmm. And I began teaching documentary filmmaking to graduate students in the context of a graduate class in historic preservation. So the first three films that we did were actually films on historic preservation, in which the students were asked to do a film specifically about some aspect of historic preservation, because that's what they were doing in the graduate program. Just this last spring, just finished this spring, I shifted the approach a little bit, and I offered a graduate class called State and Local History. And that class had students in it where their only job was to make a film on some topic in state and local history. And I gave them complete freedom to pick a subject, telling them that they had to pick a subject that they could do, because this is a film, not a term paper or a research paper. And so we ended up with four films, each about 10 or 12 minutes long, on different aspects of the history, really of the history of Murfreesboro, as it turned out. And that was the approach then. And all along the way, when I first started doing this in 2006, I'd been thinking about offering a class to undergraduates, a class that couldn't be a really large, typical class of 30 or 35 students, but one that would have to be capped because of access to the studio, access to facilities, that kind of thing. So I knew I was going to do it at the undergraduate level. It was just a matter of when. And when I finally made my decision, I decided that this fall coming up in 2008 would be a good time to offer it for the first time. And if it does well, if it goes well, and it should, because there's a lot of interest, as you can see, the class filled up almost instantly, I'll be offering the class again because of the interest. And I don't doubt that the students will be able to do the films and do them well, because I've already seen it. Oh, just one other thing I can mention. In my history 2010 and 2020 classes, my survey classes, when I teach them in the fall and in the spring, I've actually been offering the students the opportunity to do a documentary film instead of a term paper in my class, if they have some of the skills that are needed, and they need to be skilled with cameras, and they need to be able to do digital editing.
And how many people availed themselves of that opportunity?
It's just been a few, sometimes working in teams. But I've had three films done, one of them very good. A couple of young men did a film on Charlie Chaplin that was very well done. And I actually had another student, a very good student, who wanted to do a film on something he wasn't sure about. But he ended up doing a podcast, and he ended up doing a podcast about 35 minutes long on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, of all things, and just very, very well done. So, and the other films that were not done as well were still very exciting to me, because I can really see that in a history class where students are sometimes, they have to take the class, mm-hmm. these general studies classes, and some of them, they don't really like history, or they think of history as being, you know, rigid. It's nothing but dates and facts. And then along comes a professor and says, well, why don't you try doing a film, or try doing something else? And I'm not the only one who does that, but I think I'm the only one who actually offers them a chance to do a film. And some of them just really react. And sometimes it's the students in mass comm who have the digital editing skills. But what I'm finding is a lot of these young people, as opposed to the graduate students, do have experience with digital equipment, including digital editing. And in fact, the mass comm students, are some of them can do very sophisticated digital editing. But the issue is they're not just making a film for fun. They're making a film that is about some aspect of history. And if they want to do something on their family, that's one thing. But if they want to pick another subject, that's another.
I was going to ask you whether the students who have signed up for this fall class are all history majors or not.
I don't know the exact makeup of them, but most of them are history majors. But at least two of them, I know for sure, because I haven't made actual personal contact with all of them. At least two of them are mass comm majors, and one of the mass comm major, I think both of them actually are history minors. But the class is actually, it's being offered, students can take it as an elective. We anticipated in offering this class, and I say we because I'm getting some help from graduate students who helped me with the class, with technical aspects as well as, you know, things that have to do with grading and evaluating the work and that kind of thing. But we anticipated that the class will draw more from history majors than anything, but we are hoping that it will also draw from students who are in programs like Mass Comm but are history minors, or maybe even students who are going, I don't like history, but hey, I get a chance to do something very different. And they may say, gee, maybe I should minor in history or maybe even major in history. We're not out trying to draw students away from other programs, but I have a kind of, it's almost a kind of religious conviction that maybe isn't 100% accurate because it's maybe more faith than reality, but I really do believe that students will thrive in doing history in a different way when they can approach it through a different medium, through new media. The opportunity to do something like this instead of writing a term paper is going to draw people in a way that you may not draw other people, or you may not draw students in. Chance to do something different.
The technical quality of the film, I know it's a history class, but how much does the technical quality of the film bear on the grading?
Yeah, that's, we've actually worked on that a lot. I generated a rubric this year to use for grading and evaluating the students' work, and I won't go through the details of it. It'd be kind of boring on the radio, but to make a long story short, about half of the grade will be based on the content of the film. But I've actually created percentages for the quality of the visuals that they use. Obviously, film is a visual medium. I've actually included a percentage for creativity, telling the students that when you do a documentary film, we expect you to stretch a little bit. We expect you to demonstrate something that you wouldn't have to demonstrate in doing a film. And we look at how they use, if they choose to use music. Is the music appropriate? Does it set the mood and the tone? So they are being asked to do some things that they may never have done before or that they may have done in a playful way. And things that I've learned, for example, in the spring class when the students chose music for their films, and all four of the students who did films did, I was literally blown away when they came in with their rough cuts and how effectively they had used music to set a tone and a mood for the film. I was very, very impressed with that. The technical aspect of, there's another side to it, and that is learning the skills that they need to learn. What really impressed me in this recent semester, I was concerned when the students first came in, if you just excuse me, I was concerned when the students came in as graduate students that they would be able to learn how to use the new technology as effectively as I wanted them to be able to do the film, because they have to learn Mac technology. We provide the students with a laptop and with the opportunity to work in our film studio. Just a quick aside, we got a TIF grant a year or so ago of approximately $114,000, which we used to buy a lot of the equipment. We already had some, but we were able to upgrade and buy some additional equipment. So we really have state-of-the-art Mac laptops. We have computer equipment. We have digital cameras, video as well as still cameras. We have lighting systems.
And this equalizes the playing field for those students who don't have a gazillion dollars to spend and are barely able to afford paying for their books compared to students who are from much more well-off families and can afford to buy their own cameras and their own editing equipment.
Yeah, in a sense, the course isn't very expensive for them because they will be given a laptop to use for the semester. They will also have access to the cameras, still video cameras, as well as to the more sophisticated computer and digital editing equipment in our little studio. It's just a little studio. And to the lighting equipment, which means that they can do, in fact, one of the requirements of the class is that they learn to do interviewing, lighted and sounded, if that's a word. That's a tough word to use.
Audio editing?
Yeah, audio editing as well. So that means that they will sometimes have talking heads in their films that are properly lighted and properly mic'd so that the sound comes through effectively.
But they also have to have action, movement, and they have to it can't just all be talking heads mm-hmm. and still photographs from the 1800s or whatever. There has to be some movement, right?
The mistake that the undergraduate students that I've had in my classes make, if they make mistakes in their films, is they'll take the camera in and talk to some guy, and they point the camera at him and let him talk, and they don't do much else. And as I told the students with regard to the genealogy films, I've met with some students to talk to them about it, is that one of the things they have to watch out for is that they can't think of this as playing with their video camera and then downloading it on the TV or downloading it on their computer or something like that. That this is serious business. It's meant to be fun, but it's also serious. What I mean by that is that, yes, you have that uncle, right? He's a funny guy, and you like being around and that kind of thing. You want to do a film on him. And then I'm going, well, okay, but the problem with doing a film on that funny uncle is that you have to make it historically relevant in some way. What are you going to say about this uncle? How are you going to make it interesting to other people? As everybody knows, there's nothing more boring than listening to people talk about the relatives that you don't know.
Right.
Unless they can tell interesting stories about them. And one of the models that I've been using, among many, is in fact a student who came into the graduate program. Her name is Ashley Oates. She came into the graduate program here from Maryville College. And she had done a senior thesis is what it's called over there. And for her senior thesis, she made a documentary film. And she did a film on two of her great uncles who had been World War II veterans. And what she did is she told their story because she had what she needed. What she had, main thing that she had to do her documentary film was letters that had been written by these two men to their families, and they had been saved. And so she had all this information about how they went from basic training all the way through to World War II and all the way through the war. And then she had maps and she had other information in order to talk about the experience of soldiers in World War II. Well, what gave the story great, great interest and what made it really touching in the end was watching the tension, and you're wondering, what's going to happen to these guys? So it's the story. And as you learn, as the film unfolds, you learn that one of the men survived and the other one, yeah, she actually has the telegram. A letter from one of the uncles writing back about being in a particular battle, and then they get a note indicating that he's been wounded, and then they get a telegram indicating that he's died. And it's just a very moving film.
So basically what she did was just develop a narrative arc and employed a storytelling technique as though she were doing a feature film, except that she was doing it using real life and real facts.
Exactly, and it is a true story about her family members. And another thing she did that we want to encourage the students to do, because we have issues with music and copyright and fair use, is that we encourage the students to use public domain music or also to they can compose their own music on programs that come with the Mac computers called GarageBand, and there are others as well. But one of the things that Ashley did with her film is she went to the music college, and she had some friends over there, and she went over there and she got a fellow, a guy and a woman who were musicians and who were studying for music degrees. They actually took a poem called My Laddie Isn't Coming Home, and they actually took a poem and put music to it and performed it. So there were no copyright or fair use issues because they agreed to do it, and they got their name on the credits, and they performed the music. And the film ends with this very, very touching song, this very touching music, after you learn about the death of her great uncle, and it's very moving. And this is an undergraduate student. She was 20 years old at the time, I believe, exercising incredible creativity and indeed without a lot of support. The students here in the genealogy class will have a lot of support from a graduate student who has already been making films, as well as another graduate student named Angela Smith, who's have been working with me for a couple of years, and she's in the PhD program here, and it's really unusual, but she has a lot of experience in not making films herself, but in teaching filmmaking, and she has a lot of technical skills. So she's provided us with a lot of help. So one of the things that we are sure about is that their films are not only going to have content, because they're going to go through a semester of research and that kind of thing, but they're going to be technically very well done. The students in the spring class, what impressed me is how quickly they learned the new program. So what they have to learn is, they have to learn from the Mac program, they have to learn the new Leopard operating system, which is different from the old Mac operating system. Some of them have already done work with Macs, and so it's not new to them. But what I was surprised by is how quickly they moved from PC work to the Mac. But they have to learn that. They have to learn iPhoto, which is quite easy to learn and is very, very nicely laid out. And they have to learn what's called iMovie, which is a little bit more difficult to learn, and they've kind of changed it in some ways that they shouldn't have. And then they learn iDVD to be able to make their own DVDs. Well, some of these younger people already know how to do all of this stuff. Even if they don't know Macs, they know how to do this stuff. And when it comes to using still cameras, most of them are experienced with still cameras. Many of them have their own cameras, digital cameras. What many of them don't have is experience with the video cameras and experience with interviewing. The other thing that they will learn is, because we'll probably require it of every student, is when they do oral interviews, they have to learn some of the techniques of oral interviews, which means we need to teach them something about how to interview people, how to get information from them, how to interrupt them and not interrupt them, mm-hmm. How to ask good questions, how to get the information that you want from them. And that's not an easy thing to do. It looks easy for people from the outside, but you know very well, because you do this every day, that right. It is not easy.
Do historians and journalists employ different interviewing techniques?
I don't know that they're different. The field keeps changing. When I was first taught oral interviewing techniques, I was told to come in armed with dozens and dozens of questions, because, you know, you really have to make sure that you get all the information that you need. And over time, it's changed. What they now teach you is to be quiet yourself as an interviewer and let the interviewee speak, and don't be uncomfortable with pauses. And sometimes you need to bring in, you know, maps and things like that to show them, so that it can jar their memory. Younger people have different memories than older people. You find a lot of times with older people, because of the way the brain works, that their short-term memory is not as good as their long-term memory.
Now, the only time you have to be uncomfortable with pauses is when you're live on the air.
Yeah.
Because nature abhors a vacuum and radio abhors dead air, and so does television. But on the other hand, since this is all pre-recorded and they have editing equipment, they can take care of that later on in the process.
That's right. And what we have to teach them is some of the issues that are involved in editing. We have to tell the person being interviewed, for example, is that when you finish answering a question, there's going to be a little pause before I ask the next question, because of editing reasons. We may want to use exactly the very last breath you said in it, and so we don't want to jump in and start talking.
You don't want to get it too tight. Suppose, for example, the person starts remembering something that's very poignant or very difficult emotionally, and they start to weep just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You want to give them that moment, then not only for your purposes of capturing that moment on tape, but to give them that moment where they can collect themselves. It's just mm-hmm. Out of sheer human courtesy.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes those very moving moments, and when you're videotaping them and you can actually see the reaction of the person, can be a very touching part of the film, especially if the person isn't embarrassed by it. And sometimes they are, especially men. They are maybe embarrassed by a display of emotion. But, we're not trying to get that out of people. But as we tell the students, sometimes you move into territory that creates a reaction. I mean, you know, men and women who have gone through traumatic experiences in their past and now are asked to talk about it again, whether it's the Vietnam War or maybe some kind of physical abuse, that is something that can come up, and they have to be aware of that. And we talk about that. I've had students do oral histories of Vietnam veterans, for example, and I warn them, you know, when you talk to a Vietnam veteran who agrees to talk to you, because sometimes they won't, be aware that when they start talking about their experiences, they may, you know, big tough guys, you know, it's not an easy experience for them to talk to you when they're bringing up something that was troublesome. And that may happen in family histories as well.
What if your student comes to you and says, I'm having my family, my relatives, they're just very private people, and I'm having a hard time getting them to cooperate. And if you can't collect enough interviews or enough information to make something work in its entirety. Now, with this, they have the option of going the MTSU route. But if they want to go the family route and they can't get their relatives, I mean, you could create a little tension there within the family structure.
Absolutely. And what I would do is immediately discourage them from trying to force people into talking to them. If they can't get them to interview either on audio or on videotape, and they don't want to be interviewed, sometimes people are okay with an interview on an audio tape, but they don't want to be on screen for whatever reasons. That's fine, as long as they agree to it. They have to sign a release anyway. We will not tape anybody or use anybody's language or words without their signing release saying it's okay for them to be shown on the video. Because these films, in the short run, these films are going to be shown around the university and around the community within the realm of education. In the long run, who knows? I mean, it may be that we start producing films, short and long films, that can be posted on YouTube, that might even be marketable, might even be sold. I'm trying not to be too megalomaniac about this because I don't want the people to feel... I don't want the stakes to be too high on these students when they're doing their first film. I don't want them to be thinking, oh, this is going to be on the History Channel, or this is going to be on National Public Radio, or National Public TV, rather, or whatever. I don't want them to have that kind of pressure on them. But in time, as we build this program, that might become very possible. And that's why we have to deal effectively with issues of copyright and fair use.
What do you tell your students about the dangers of manipulating the new technology to skew or distort the facts? Because this is a history class, you have to put a premium on the truth.
One of the things that you teach when you're doing a documentary film right away is that in history, students are trained to think about how do you interpret a particular topic, if it's a family member or an event or something like that. And they're actually trained that history is interpretation. People often think that a fact is a fact and it's just the facts, ma'am, and that kind of thing. But all of history is an interpretation, and they have to understand that. But when it comes to documentary filmmaking, what we tell them is that no documentary film will ever work if it just becomes a rant, if it just becomes you giving or you're giving your point of view or you're offering your point of view without building any tension into it, alternative ways of thinking about things. Now, there may not be a natural disagreement or a disagreement over interpreting some aspect of a family history. But if they're doing a film that may have some controversy in it or may have different points of view, what we encourage them to do is go out and talk to all sides and let them speak for themselves. You can have a point of view yourself as the filmmaker. You can draw conclusions that may be exactly the same as your film draws, but let the audience draw its own conclusions, because if you rant, you're going to turn them off. Even if they agree with you, they're going to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think people understand that.
But you know as well as I do that it's very easy to manipulate digital editing, both in audio and video, to make it appear that somebody said something they didn't say, to take quotes out of context, to make people appear either foolish or to make them appear less foolish than they would have in reality, in the course of things. And is there a temptation there with the students if the family member is discussing something that might be a little embarrassing, might be a little bit touchy? Suppose grandma admits she had a back alley abortion back in the day or something like that, to just kind of, you know, excise that and not make it part of the record.
Yeah, one side of it is to be kind of hard-nosed about it, and that is that if you agree to go on tape or on videotape, you sign the release form, then you are agreeing to say certain things to me that I get to use. On a technical level, I get to use anything you say. So if you don't want it broadcast in some way out there in the world, don't say it. You have control over the interview yourself. So that's the kind of hard-nosed approach to it. On the other hand, I think the way in which we can avoid that kind of thing, is the fact that the classes are designed, and this is a challenge for me, but the classes are designed to have a structure in which the students and myself and the graduate students are interacting. We're going to see the rough cut. We're going to talk about the story. And, of course, it is a storytelling approach that we use. And we will discourage them from doing that kind of thing if it seems inappropriate, and that there are going to be many, many voices. Now, I'm the teacher. I get the final word in it. But the last thing I want to do is destroy their creativity and get in their way. And if they come up with interesting camera angles or interesting special effects, or if they can get somebody to say something that is fairly pithy or controversial, we don't want to necessarily take that out of the film. But the other issues you raise, I haven't seen much of that yet, and it may be because most of these students are doing their first films, and they haven't developed the techniques you're talking about, the ability to distort, the ability to get an unusual lighting or unusual camera angle or a juxtaposition of information that gives an impression or distorts the impression. I don't think they're that good at it yet, but you're right. It is an interesting thing you brought up because we have to watch out for that. And the main way that we check that, I think, so far has been that, for example, when the students were working on their films on historic preservation, one of the students did a film on the way in which the city is sprawling and it's destroying some of the Stones River battlefield, and he felt very strongly about it. And he went in and he interviewed people who also felt very strongly about it. But one of his interviews is also with a person who is in the U.S. Chamber of Murfreesboro or Rutherford County Chamber of Commerce, offering her view from the business community's perspective on heritage resources and what we're doing and that kind of thing. So his film has a point of view, but he gave other people the chance to talk about what they think the future of the county ought to be. And as you well know, that's very controversial, and you can really get into, I mean, I had a student who dropped out of the class for health reasons, but she was going to do a film on the Bible Park issue. and we talked extensively about making sure that she had the point of view of the developers and the politicians, as well as the point of view of the people who were adamantly opposed to it in the film, because that's what was going to make it interesting.
Right.
Because of the issues
you
raised.
You can't let them make a polemic. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. they're not Michael Moore.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to do that. For the students who do something about the history of MTSU, how do you keep the Gore Center from being inundated? I mean, there are other sources than the Gore Center, obviously, and they have to use multiple sources, but I anticipate the Gore Center is going to be one of the busiest places on campus between now and 2011.
It's going to be busy, and maybe so is the library as well, because of the project they have over there for collecting information and digitizing information
right.
from sidelines and that kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've talked with Lisa Pruitt, the director over there, and the incoming director, Jim Williams. And Jim is very interested in it because, as you probably know, he's been doing all of this oral history of World War II veterans and collecting information on the history of the university. So the Gore Center is actually going to have to be prepared for that. And I think they are. I think that they're going to have more people there in the fall than they may have in some other falls. But you see, because of the university centennial coming up, there are other projects in the works as well. I'm actually on two committees. I'm on what they call the President's Centennial Committee, and what we're working on is some kind of a coffee table book that is going to be more of a coffee table and story history of the university. That's one committee, but we also have a history department committee where we're going to do more of an academic book where we're going to do individual articles on particular aspects of the history of the university, and Jim Williams is on that committee. And so I think he's very well attuned or very well apprised of the fact that he's going to get a lot of activity over there.
Sounds like it's going to be a very busy next 3 years for the history department as well.
Well, indeed it is, because what I'm doing now, and in fact, what I want to get the students involved in is the reason you've seen the class says genealogy, doing family history, and also says history of the university is because I want the students in these classes to do short films that will become either short films sitting on their own right as histories of the university or histories of aspects of the university, may appear on a website as an MPEG, something like that, or may end up being incorporated into a longer film. What I would like to do personally is a history of the university, I don't know how long it would be, that is not you know, a kind of a public relations type of film, but more that is more of a film of the history of the university and shows how it's evolved over time, highlighting particular incidents. But at the moment, my plan is, and I've actually got it worked out, is that I'm calling it Decades. And what I'm thinking of doing is making sure we have at least one short film on every decade of the history of the university, from 1911 to 2011. So there'll be a film on the 19-teens, one in the 1920s, one in the 1930s. That's a little too rigid because, as you know, there's going to be more information as we move forward in time. So we may end up with several films on the 1960s or several films on the 1970s, or who knows? It just depends on what the students are. It's going to depend partly on what I want done, and it's going to be partly on what the students want to do and are willing to do. And that may sound a little odd, but one of the things I've learned is that if I say, you know, Joe or Mary, I want you to do a film on the Vietnam War in 1960s at MTSU, and they go, I don't care about that. I'm not going to make them do that film. I'm going to find somebody who is excited about the topic. And so my thinking is that we may end up with films on topics that I have never even thought of and can't even imagine at this time. And that's great. That's cool. That's just perfectly fine with me.
And it may be very important to get a hold of and interview some of the participants in MTSU history as quickly as possible because they are aging. Some of them are infirm, and without being too morbid about it, time is of the essence.
Oh, yeah, and we have already identified some of those people, not me in particular, but Jim Williams and some of the others who are, and in fact, that's kind of a priority as they look for the older people. So they've been interviewing alumni of the university going back, people who literally are older, and that is kind of a priority. But what that means to the folks out there who are listening to this, and that includes people who are faculty here who have been here for a long time, as well as alumni who are out there and who are associated with the university and who are living in the community, because we want to talk about the relationship between the university and the community very definitely. And what that means is they're going to be getting emails and phone calls because people are going to want to talk to them. I mean, we have people who have worked here for 30 years and more who have a lot to say about the history of the university, and in some cases may be the only, not only a source, but in some cases may be the only source to provide certain types of information. So oral history is going to be a big part of it. And we are developing, we will, because of the nature of what we were doing, we will add to the oral history projects that have already been put in place here.
Dr. Lorne McWaters, history professor at MTSU, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. And don't forget, MTSUnews.com is your source for the podcast, and we're also available on iTunes.